Hello and welcome to Sprogcast, a radio show all about pregnancy, birth and early parenting, hosted by Karen Hall and Mark Harris and supported by Pinter and Martin. Okay, it's Sprogcast once again. This is episode 16. I'm Karen Hall. Here's Mark Harris.
Hi, Karen. I'm looking forward to this episode. It's a little celebration of midwifery. And we've got interviews with Professor Dennis Walsh and the newly qualified midwife, Natalie Corden.
Yeah.
It's great. It's great, isn't it? We've got kind of both ends of the spectrum.
I don't know if Dennis would appreciate being described as the opposite end of the spectrum. He's in the height of his career.
I sat across from a dinner table with him and did that interview, and he's looking very good. It has to be said, lost some weight, looking very good indeed. Definitely in the prime of his life.
All right, then. That's better. Sprogcast is brought to you by our wonderful sponsor, Pinter and Martin, an independent publishing company specialising in pregnancy, birth and parenting, psychology, nutrition and yoga at pinterandmartin.com. And you can find us on facebook.com/sprogcast and Twitter at sprogcast. And it's great if you come and talk to us.
Oh, do come and talk to us. We crave feedback, don't we, Karen?
We do. So we've got this episode coming out now, and you will also have, as a special treat, our August episode coming out on the 25th of August will be the live, the edited version of the live event that we did last week, as we speak.
We recorded it live.
Yes. We were there. There were all people in a room.
It was buzzing. In fact, I'm still buzzing from it.
It
exceeded my expectations. The speakers were amazing, without a doubt.
I loved Rebecca's storytelling voice. So we had Rebecca Schiller told us a story. It was like being read our bedtime story, wasn't it?
Well, she was brilliant.
Yeah, it was great. Amy Brown... our breastfeeding researcher and a Pinter and Martin author whose book is going to be coming out in September, I think. Very comedic.
She came a long way as well.
She did. She came all the way from Swansea just to be on Sprogcast. That was nice. And then we had Natalie Meddings, and I think a lot of people in the audience were very moved by the stories that she told.
Very much so.
We are hoping to do another one of those if Pinter and Martin will have us. They very kindly hosted the event at EFRASpace, but maybe early next year. And we've had a few requests to take it to other parts of the country. And so we'd quite like to look at doing that during 2017 as well. But we do need to start thinking about covering our costs. So if you came to the event, or even if you didn't come to the event but you'd like us to come to you, a question on our Facebook page at the moment is, how much would you be prepared to pay for something like this? Because we don't really know where to pitch it. So let us know what you think.
It's that balance between wanting to make such an informative, moving, entertaining event available to everyone, but at the same time making sure that when people travel from Swansea that we can refund some of that travel expenditure.
It would be nice to be able to do that, and it's hard to imagine any better speakers than we had, but it would be lovely to get some variety as well.
Oh yeah, I think we should encourage those that are kind of listening to us now to forward some names.
Oh yeah, or just volunteer.
Yeah, volunteer yourself. Forward some names, volunteer yourself.
So shall we move on and look at some of the news articles that we've got this week?
Let's do that. Some interesting stuff there, Garen.
Did you read any of it?
Yeah, of course I did. I mean, one of the articles is from my hometown.
Yes, I saw that.
Leicester University.
Yes.
It's called Five Reasons Why We Need to Look at Birth and the Media.
Dr. Ranjana Das from the Department of Media and Communication is that at Leicester Uni?
Centre of the Academic University.
So tell us about this study.
She's proposing a study and launching a study looking at the influence of the media in all its forms upon perceptions and expectations around birth. She started a project called Birth Stories, a British Academy project funded by them, and a whole range of data gathering methodologies based around 50 mothers in England talking about their experiences.
Where does the media stuff come into it?
Well, if you look at the introduction to the article, Five Reasons Why We Need to Look at Childbirth Media, and she outlines them quite clearly. I mean, some of them we would have talked about before. Media images and texts shape the kind of expectations and emotions women carry into the labouring room. The demands women make of themselves, the expectations they have of what can, to an extent, be an unpredictable process, and the yardsticks with which mothers assess their birth experiences all occur within a mediated
Yeah,
context.
we are very much immersed in what's going on socially around us. So, who hasn't got a phone in their hand and reading Facebook
Absolutely right.
and the news and whatever? So you can't ever take it out of that context now, can we?
The vast majority of what we take on board inside our kind of processing mechanisms is unconscious. So before you know it, you're responding in what seems a spontaneous way, but at a deeply unconscious level, you're being influenced by all the media that you expose yourself to. It begins to shape expectations for what you will experience in the birth room, because it's what you've seen, it's what you've heard, it's what you've enjoyed as entertainment. And before you know it, that starts to influence behavior in profound ways. So, for example, you will very rarely see upright birth on popular media. You do from time to time, and when you do, it's
Yeah,
unusual.
it's some woman hanging from the rafters of her barge.
Yeah. I mean, she makes some other points. Birth is idealized or conversely medicalized and too often graded on the media. And this could contribute to feelings of inadequacy post-birth. She's pointing to not just idealized birth, but medicalized birth. And then she's talking about inside social media forums, one or the other either gets eulogized or demonized, which then creates an internal measurement for her own experience before she's even had it. So she's assuming if her experience isn't this way, it's not the right one. If it is this way, it's a bad one. So her stories are being shaped even before she's been through an experience of her own.
This is exactly how I started my antenatal session last night. Flip chart on the floor, and two headings: TV labour, ideal labour, and getting people to just
Brilliant.
sort of identify the things that they have encountered through the media and the things that they'd actually like.
Yeah.
There is a crossover sometimes because they identify that on TV it's usually pretty quick and they'd like that.
Yeah, yeah,
But they
yeah.
also identify that on TV, the woman's either on her back with her legs in stirrups or she's in a taxi, and they don't want
Yeah.
either of those.
Yeah. I mean, she goes on in this paper to raise the issue of birth experiences shape the earliest phases of parenting and in the ways in which social media is or can be used at these times deserves critical attention. She's right, in my opinion. It's a vast area. And too often, those with polarized opinions get to shape the narrative.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a bit biased here, Karen. I love Rebecca Sheila's work. Her interview on Sprodcast has been one of the highlights of the last 16 months. She's got a book out.
Yes, the Why Human Rights in Childbirth Matter. This is going to be such an important book.
It's definitely going to be a must-read for birth workers and for all pregnant women, I would say. It's published by Pinter & Martin, our sponsor. It's in the Birth Matters series. There's a bit of an advert here for a campaign that they're suggesting.
Yeah, I really like this idea. It's hosting a fundraising book club to put the issues of human rights in childbirth in the spotlight. And so we've got the link on Facebook for you if you want to register to have a book club event, which I'm definitely gonna do. Maybe we'll kind of talk about that again in September.
I think we will. They're suggesting that we do this in the week commencing the 17th of October, and to join in the conversation using hashtag new chapter on social
Yeah,
media.
definitely one to keep an eye on there. Have you seen the Science and Sensibility blog about hormonal physiology of childbearing?
I have it in front of me.
Okay, what do you think?
Yeah, it's written by Penny Sipkins, who's an all-time hero of mine. I think some of her books have been extraordinary, particularly books that informed my practice, the Labour Progress Handbook.
I like the birth partner. Was that Simkin?
Yeah, that's her. That's a brilliant book, quite
Yeah.
thick, but full of lots of great information. And of course, a very important book, When Survivors Give Birth. So she's got a long history in the trade, Karen. She's talking to the long-awaited book written by Dr. Sarah Buckley, Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing, Evidence and Implications for Women, Babies and Maternity Care. It's being released by Childbirth Connection.
Right. And she says it's a gift to us all. Why?
Well, it explores the kind of hormonal physiology of the childbearing process, you know, that's rooted in millions of years of evolutionary adaptive responses in the human animal. And she's really pointing to the things that many of our listeners kind of know already. You know, the importance of oxytocin in the process, the importance of not being disturbed, whatever that means for the woman. It's an important book. It's a big book. There's going to be a sort of like a short user's guide to it, a consumer booklet, no less. So
I
important.
think that's probably a good idea when you're producing a big book, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, some books, you know, not to name
Don't
any,
name it.
are certain. I'm not going to, but they're certainly not accessible to not just the general public, but even professionals who want to have a ready, accessible source for the information.
Yeah.
Very important. I think also what's important about this book is encouraging those who have kind of structural leadership to think very carefully before they introduce an intervention, no matter what that intervention is. In fact, it places the onus upon those who are introducing an intervention to come up with the evidence that it's not going to cause harm.
Yeah.
In the conclusion of this article that we're discussing, Penny writes, "Typically, maternity care today has departed so far from physiology that in many cases it causes more harm than good, as borne out by Dr. Buckley's discussion throughout the book of the impact, unintended consequence, if you will, of common maternity care practices on hormonal physiology and the mother and baby outcomes."
It's so hard to get that across, though, isn't it? I mean, we know this. Doulas know this. Midwives know this. But the people who are there at the centre of it all just don't. And it's, I suppose, coming back to Dr. Das's research about childbirth and the media, isn't it? Their expectations are so far removed from this because what goes on is they get processed into the system and never question it.
That's right. I mean, she does say unintended consequences, which to me points to innocence at one level amongst practitioners that are functioning inside the structures that they function inside of. I published an article that I published before called 17 Phrases I'd Like Midwives to Consider Stopping Using. And it always generates a certain level of anger amongst some people. And they'll say, "Well, you're being politically correct. You're making an issue out of something that isn't an issue." And I very gently point out that language frames our experience, that the very first thing that begins to change in a culture is how we use language, because we experience the world through it. And the fact that these phrases come up so often, you know, I always get that comment, "Oh, I heard that today, twice." It's because it's parlance for the area. It's accepted. It fits in with all the paradigms that are going on and swimming around, that we don't recognize the impact that that's having on people outside of our system.
And that's because for the health professional saying it, it's just a normal thing to say. It's just something that in their head they hear all the time. But for a parent hearing it for the first time, it has a greater impact. And it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that the person saying it thinks it means.
I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, all words in many ways work in that way. A word is like a compacted summary of all the things that are going on beneath it in people's unconscious and conscious minds. So when we say the word, we just assume the other person is having a similar experience as they hear the word. But that is never happening in conversation. We're always coming up with our own experience-based interpretation of what someone else is saying to us.
But also in a conversation, you can clarify, can't you? You can question it. You
Exactly.
can confirm that you understood correctly. And in the sort of conversations people have when they're going to go to have a baby, and they're in hospital and it's all very exciting and a bit scary and their body's doing this stuff that they've never done before, and a midwife tells them to do something, they are not in a frame of mind for questioning it and clarifying it.
No, very often not. And I mean, words are like icons on the desktop. You know, when you click on the icon, you get all the stuff underneath it. But you're right, you have to do the clicking to uncover
What a
it.
lovely analogy. I like
Do you
that.
like
Yeah,
that?
I do. What do you think about this US article about pregnant moms' food choices tied to baby's body composition?
Well, it's 1,040 infant pairs, mother infant
That's quite a
pairs.
lot.
Yeah, it's quite. I don't think they mentioned the confidence interval in terms of statistical analysis in this summary, but it does suggest, doesn't it, an increase in the fatty tissue on babies whose mothers consumed more saturated fats and carbohydrates.
It does, although it's all self-reported. The researchers asked the women to recall everything they had eaten during the previous 24 hours. Can you do that?
Most people can't, can they? Most people
Definitely
can't,
not.
without a doubt. So I mean, methodologically, it's flawed. And in terms of an intuitive response to it, hey, what do you know? Women that eat sugar and carbohydrates are more likely to have babies that are larger.
It says may not necessarily give birth to heavier babies, but may have
No,
infants with
but
more fat tissue.
yeah, that's they do make that distinction. So.
They don't sort of examine cause and effect very much, though, do they? I
No.
mean, maybe women who are genetically predisposed to have that kind of fat composition themselves or in their baby also eat more of that kind of food. I don't know.
Well, and you know, and the feeding choices of the mothers of the mothers would be an important question, one would think, after our last
That's certainly
episode.
what Maureen Minchin would say.
Yeah, without a doubt. And there is some growing epigenetic evidence that's suggesting that our heritage has an impact on our body mass, which is a welcome message, I think, for some of us who have kind of struggled with obesity our whole lives. It doesn't excuse, you know, poor food choices, but it does set it in a larger frame that can generate compassion for those that are struggling with things like weight loss
It
and
does, though
so on.
this particular study doesn't seem to be going quite that deeply. And it's basically the same public health message that applies to everybody, whether you're pregnant or not, doesn't it? Just eat less rubbish food.
Yeah. What does it say at the bottom here? Healthy gain in early pregnancy is especially important. Just a couple of pounds in the first trimester, Oaken says. Women should aim to gain within the recommended amounts by continuing to exercise regularly and eating a nutritiously dense diet. Avoid empty calories such as those in sugary beverages, candy, and diets. Do you know, where do they get the money to do these studies,
I
Karen?
was just thinking that.
Because I've got a bridge I want to sell them.
Anyway, moving on.
Finally, Karen,
Yes.
an antenatal class that reduces cesarean sections by 44%.
That's impressive.
Important news from the land down under has been published in the British Medical Journal this week. A new antenatal program called She Births has been seeing amazing results in Australian hospitals, although the study was relatively small, 179 couples. The results are promising, showing that women who did the course had a faster labor, experiencing less pain, and had fewer interventions. The first thing that strikes me is the measuring criteria that constitutes success.
Yeah, fast.
Get it done fast, experience less pain, and fair enough, fewer interventions. I mean, that potentially is a good marker when we're measuring the efficacy of any intervention.
And,
Boom, boom.
a fast labour is what parents say they want.
Of course, if all the media permeates you with it's better to have a faster labour, but you know, if I was a woman and I was orgasmic as I was birthing, I might not want it over quick.
Maybe, yeah.
So, what I'm saying is, you know, we talked about orgasmic birth in previous episodes, and it is such a confronting and controversial subject. Why? Well, because we swim in different waters in terms of our media. So the very idea of being orgasmic in the context of birth is confronting, So maybe there are a large portion of women that want faster labors, and maybe as a man, I don't have any position to speak on that. But that desire is coming from somewhere. It's been implanted in many ways through media expectations.
But also, it seems like a natural thing. When you've waited for 9 months, you want to meet your baby, and birth is not going to be orgasmic for the majority of women in this day and age. So let's face it, they might want to get past that and meet their baby.
Oh, without a doubt. I don't think, birth should be a long time. I don't think it should be orgasmic. I think it should be an experience that the woman has herself as she creates stories around it, enhances her life, both in the birth process and beyond. So, yeah, in all the years I've been a midwife, the vast majority of women have this, if not stated, they'll often say, I know it's not a due date, but my due date is.
Yeah.
And their experience starts to shift as they go over due date. It's all embedded in the language that the baby isn't coming at the time it was expected, even though, 75% of women experiencing their first pregnancy will go over that date.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the structural things that we could start to alter very easily.
Yes.
In terms of our language, of course, the administration and the logistics of fitting in all the inductions becomes problematic if you're not explicit about some kind of date.
You could still use the window.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I'm sure a birth window would upset some people.
Yeah, probably.
It's pointing towards cesarean section.
What is?
A window. I'm joking. Cut it out.
I will.
Anyway, some of the statistics in this study are interesting for the 179 couples anyway. 65% reduction in epidural rates, 44% reduction in cesarean section rates, 50% reduction in medical augmentation, which is effectively speeding up labour via syntocinon, 53% reduction in the need for resuscitation, defined by the need for oxygen and suctioning, and a 12% reduction in perineal trauma.
This set of classes, or whatever it is, this course, involves a lot of basically breathing and relaxation techniques, yeah. A lot of yoga. So it kind of fits in with that sort of section of coping strategies.
Yeah. I mean, you cover that in the NCT, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The things on breathing, relaxation, visualization, all that kind of thing. It's not a course that's only about that, like, say, a yoga for pregnancy or a hypnobirthing course.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of other stuff in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does say in this article, but it winds you up, NCT courses vary widely from teacher to teacher.
Well, that's true. We are all individual practitioners.
Yeah, but where it doesn't vary widely is in the rigour and the preparation and the training that NCT teachers get. I mean, it's a rigorous program at university study level, and that at very least leads to a continuity in terms of quality of the information and the content being offered.
Oh, this, of course, is in my experience. NCT is much about meeting other parents to be as preparing for birth in the aftermath. We know that. That is part of what we're trying to do. It's certainly not the only thing we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure all the people offering pregnancy acupressure are doing a happy dance. Yeah, shall we listen to one of our interviews? We've got two for you today.
Yeah.
We've got Dennis Walsh to have a listen to, and then we'll follow that with Natalie Corden. So here's Dennis.
Dennis, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed today. I'm sure there aren't many people out there that don't know you, but could you introduce yourself and just say a little bit about what you're doing now and your background?
Okay, so I came to the UK in the early 80s, trained as a midwife then, so I've been a midwife 25 plus years, or nearly 30.
Yeah.
Worked in practice initially in Leicester, and then latter years in academic university sort of work, so now work at Nottingham University.
Right.
So, yeah, the project that we've got running is a Department of Health funded project on midwifery unit utilisation in England.
Oh, we'll come back to that.
Yep.
Did you do all your clinical work in Leicester?
Pretty much, yeah. Done a little bit in a couple of other places, but no, vast majority of it's all been in Leicester up to 2000.
And so you worked as a sort of like an on-the-ground midwife for a while.
Yeah.
You were the first male midwife in Leicester, without a doubt. I was the second, but you were the first.
Yes.
Groundbreaking. Yeah. I think Paul Lewis probably came before you.
Yeah, he was before us.
How did you find it? You know, given that Leicester is such a multicultural city and you're an Aussie.
Yeah, I mean, I was very aware of the need to sort of build rapport and, you know, spend time chatting with women to build up a bit of trust.
Yeah.
I had, in the early days, quite a few women had a double take, if you like, seeing a male attendant. But if I sensed any unease, I just withdrew quietly, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I found in the main that if you built the rapport, that was usually fine and people would accept you.
Yeah.
But yeah, always have a high sensitivity to any reserve and always withdraw if there's some disease around it.
Knowing you like I do, you won't believe this, but I still get women coming up to me and saying they remember you looking after.
Yeah, gee, it's quite a while ago now.
Isn't that lovely?
I used to see them at the school gates when our girls were small. But no, because I haven't been in practice for so long, you kind of lose track a bit. The babies are now adults, aren't they?
Adult, I've got their own.
Yeah, probably.
Although I always had a rule that if I recognised a woman, I'd never go up and say hello unless she acknowledged me first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Same.
Yeah. So you rank and file for a while, and then what did you do in your career?
In post-changing childbirth, which is 1993, there was a lot of organisational change, which was happening in Leicester as well. So we went into team midwifery, did a couple of innovative schemes, and I was doing more sort of project lead work then.
Yeah, that was King's Fund first, wasn't it?
Right, the Midwifery Development Unit, it was called back then. Started working in the area of practice development, did a little bit of management, and then eventually went to the university.
Yeah, you were the manager of Mallory team.
Yeah, one of the original
when team. When I was a student, I remember that really clearly. And then you had a role in research and development.
Yeah, research and development. So that was after that project had stopped, and I just went into that area because I was really interested in organisational change, clinical practice development, the whole normal birth agenda, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Thought I could probably do it better in a more research and development type role.
I remember something that you were responsible for in the trust that helped me as a newly qualified midwife, and that was the clinical guidelines for so-called low-risk normal birth.
Yeah, that's right. We were the first, I think, in the country that had that little booklet that we gave out to midwives.
It was awesome. Big enough for your pocket.
Yeah, that kind of thing, based on evidence and demonstrating there was a lot of research already back then that supported normal birth that most people weren't as familiar with.
Yeah, we were into the Cochrane database back then, weren't we?
Yep.
And meta-analysis.
Yeah.
Although it wasn't without controversy, was it?
No, of course, So always wanted to emphasise the experiential part side of it, the research that comes from interviewing women, asking them about their priorities rather than just doing randomised controlled trials.
I know from a personal perspective, you know, when we speak about team work within the maternity services, you know, often it can feel like hegemony, you know, it can feel like top down. And I know some of the controversy was because you put that booklet through. And really, the anaesthetists and obstetricians didn't have much to do with it. So I can imagine that took quite a lot of courage.
Yeah. So I remember the anaesthetist coming to see me, if you remember that at the time.
I have a picture of her in my mind right now.
Yeah. She said, "What's going on here? I didn't know anything about this."
Yes. I mean, having to resist the impetus to say, "Well, would you like my input on fentanyl for spinals?"
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, given that is within their professional remit, I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding around where the boundaries of professional scope are. And that booklet certainly transformed or led to me becoming a better midwife because I had a quick reference guide.
Yeah.
So thanks for that. And then can you say a little bit about your academic journey?
Late 90s, I did the first workshop on normal birth practice and evidence testing the water a bit to see whether there was a need out there, and it sort of took off quite a bit, as you know. So I've been doing those since. But so the whole evidence base of normal birth practice needed more profiling and sharing, I thought. So I suppose that led on to thinking about research as well. And we had one of the early caseload schemes, as you remember, in 1990. Yeah. I did my master's research on that, on the experience of working or being in a caseload, women's interviews. So had the opportunity of doing a PhD on the freestanding midwifery unit.
Right.
And that was just grasped that opportunity with a very senior academic midwife, Sue Down, that you know, who's really high profile now and done loads, as you know, for the whole agenda around normal birth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, took that.
Brett, methodology for those that are interested?
Yeah, it was qualitative stuff. It's called ethnography. So that's like looking at the birthing culture.
Right.
And I think, you know, it was around that time where we started to say you can't just look at quantitative methods. You've got to look at the environment, the culture, the beliefs. And fortunately, since then, that's been validated, hasn't it? Because everybody wants to know about all that side of it now. It's not just about the measurements. It's about practice, beliefs.
Yeah, behaviour and outcome doesn't occur in a vacuum, does it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which leads us on nicely to some grant funding, some work that you're currently doing.
Yep.
It seems to me that, you know, all of your academic background today has prepared you uniquely for what's about to happen. Can you say a little bit more about what you're on the verge of, or in the middle of?
The reform in maternity services, as you know, from 1990s onwards, has been in the direction of normal birth, midwife-led care, if you like, and that includes the place of birth stuff. So very fortunate for us, I'm jumping ahead now, we had this big birthplace study that was done in England around 2005 to 2010 that very clearly showed the benefits of midwifery units. So in particular, it reduced cesarean.
Yeah.
So that also meant a reduction in cost. So policy people were starting to take notice of that and say, we need to address this. So on the back of that, we wrote up a project to say, well, we've got midwifery units, but are they being utilised fully? Are they available as a choice for women across the country? We actually knew through a few other surveys that wasn't the case. So we built an argument to say we need to map this, we need to find out how to do it better so that the benefits of lower cesareans and also reducing cost would be available for all, if you like. So that's the point behind it.
Certainly reducing cost over a median time, because short-term costs aren't necessarily reduced. And then, of course, you had the maternity report, which really just solidified the need for your work.
So that was a report that came out in the last couple of years that built on the choice agenda around place of birth, but it also endorsed midwife care, and very interestingly, it endorsed caseload. So there's actually a movement at the moment to performance manage trusts on all those aspects there, midwifery unit provision, the model of working through caseload, and lots of midwives are very excited by that.
Yeah, not surprising in some ways. Baroness Cumberledge was the chair of Changing Childbirth.
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the design of what it is you're planning
to do?
Okay. And maybe some idea of the publishing or the work, where it's going date-wise?
Okay, so we've got a project that's got three components to it. The first component was mapping the existing provision. So that was seeing how many midwifery units there were, what numbers of women were birthing in them, a little bit about the way they were staffed and organised and managed, because we don't have a huge amount on that. So we've done the first part of that. We were motivated there by thinking, well, what places are doing this really well? So the second part of our project is doing case studies in high-performing sites, which is a phrase we're using. We're also looking at low-performing. So to define that a little bit more, that means more than 20% of all women are birthing in midwifery units.
It's high.
Yeah, that's what we're saying high is. Yeah.
Okay.
And the low is under 10%.
Yeah.
And we're also going to two places that have no midwifery units.
Oh, very interesting.
So there's a number of those still, even though the choice agenda's been there. There are a number of places in England have no midwifery units, so we want to know why that's the case.
Well, what are you going to do with all that data?
Well, what we're wanting to do with it is find out and develop service specification or service recommendations for the service to say, look, if you use an midwifery units in this way from the high performing units. So basically it's facilitators and barriers and develop service spec to say, yeah, follow this template and you'll maximise that service provision.
Yeah. So you're going to arrive at a model that's tried and tested, gone through the rigour of a thoroughly well-designed academic study, and you're going to offer people some very clear guidance and action points. Wow. So, I mean, what do you think would be the optimum amount of usage of
that's it's quite a really interesting question, because when you address that, you have to engage with the whole risk culture that's very prevalent in current maternity services. So I'm going to take you back now to what a lot of midwives will remember, Ina May Gaskin, right, spiritual midwifery, is a big guru for midwifery, a USA woman, but she had her own little project going in the 60s, 70s in the farm in Tennessee. A lot of midwives remember. She reckoned that 70% of all women could birth normally. Yeah. Actually, these days, when you look at the risk stuff and all the risk factors, we're optimised. We think an optimum value would be about 35% of the population.
Right. That 35% wouldn't necessarily be the number of women that are in the category of low risk. I'm assuming that would be higher than 35%.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to get into the detail of it, you have something like 60% of all women coming out as normal. Then, of course, they may develop complications in pregnancy. Some of them might develop complications in labour. So it's a bit of a pragmatic figure, the 35%. But it is still a hot above anything that's being achieved at the moment.
No, I get that. Do you know what if you were to extrapolate across the country, what's the kind of the figure for women that are giving birth in standalone alongside?
The last time we did a measure of that, it was about 10 to 12% of all women.
Okay, so 20% is a marked
improvement.
Yeah,
cool. Nearly a doubling.
Cool. Tell us a little bit about timescale, just so that...
Yeah, so we started in December last year, and we're finishing January 2018. So it's a 26-month project, so we'll be reporting about then.
Brilliant. Dennis, I want to take you back to the workshops that you run.
Mm-hmm.
You still do those?
Yeah, I do them on the basis of invitation now, pretty much. So
you don't advertise?
No, I haven't for about 7 years or so.
Okay.
So not getting as many in the last year or two, but I think there's still a need out there. So it's a two-day event where we go through all the evidence about best practice.
How do you fit it in with all your work?
So I fit them around because I don't work full time anymore, reduced my hours, so I fit in around the rest of the week, basically.
Yeah. If anyone listening, Dennis, wanted to get in touch with you about one of those workshops, how do they do that? In fact, I want to ask you, as well as that, how do people find out about you on the web and stuff like that?
Probably the best way of doing that is just going onto the Nottingham University site and putting in my name, because I'll come up with a staff profile there with my email. Yeah. And
they can email you about the workshops?
Yeah, absolutely fine.
Don't forget, it took ages to get you on Twitter, but it's @DennisWalsh4.
But don't hold your breath with the numbers of tweets.
Just follow him. That'll encourage him. Anyway, Dennis, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah,
it's always a pleasure.
Yep, enjoyed it.
Lovely to hear you and Dennis having a chat again. We like that. That's what we had in episode 2.
You know, I really enjoyed meeting Natalie Corden. I met her at a study day not long ago. She's very articulate and she's able to speak about her experiences in a great way. So we've got Natalie Corden coming up for you now. Brand new, newly qualified midwife.
Looking for a job.
Oh, right. Looking for a job.
Natalie, when did it all start?
It started with successfully breastfeeding my second child. And that probably sounds weird, but it was, because I went to support group and sort of spoke to mothers and sort of got support myself for my breastfeeding. And then a lovely public health midwife who was working in the Sure Start Centre said to me, you know, why don't you do this? Why don't you do some breastfeeding support of others? You know, you really get on with other people, you chat away, and you've already got that, you know that I chat away. So I started doing that. So I did breastfeeding support, and then I ended up doing that in my local hospital, and I absolutely loved it. And then the same midwife came to me about sort of 6 months in and said, you know, I'm setting up a postnatal sort of doula service. What do you think about that? And I said, oh, yeah, that'd be interesting. And she said, you know, there's quite a lot of vulnerable women in the community. And I think you'd be really good sort of like helping them out at home after they've had the babies. And I thought, yeah, brilliant. And that sort of combined both, sort of the breastfeeding as well. So I started doing that. And then I sort of really got the sort of bug and thought, actually, I'd like to do this as a job. But at the same time, I was selling books for Waterstones. And obviously, I loved that job too. But I really wanted something more. So I got a job in a birth centre. In central London, which was a bit of a bad thing to do because I'd never worked in a hospital before. But I think the birth centre was something that was really good because it was, you know, women that were coming in and they were having lovely physiological births in the pool. And, you know, I saw a lovely side of midwifery and I saw midwives that really like loved their job, absolutely loved their job. So that really inspired me. So that's where I started thinking, right, actually, I want to be the midwife now. So I applied for midwifery.
I love it. You just sort of stepped up and up and up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a slow sort of like, it's taken 7 years to get to like, you know, I'm now, you know, at the end of the degree, it's taken 7 years. So it hasn't been like a, you know, oh, I want to do this and snapped into it. I think it was a slow, gradual sort of thinking, yeah, actually, I really like this. This is something that I like doing. I like being with women. And, you know, it sort of, I thought I had the sort of characteristics of someone that could do this for a living. So, yeah.
So over the course of your degree, how long was the degree? Is it 3 years?
It's 3 years, yeah.
How much practical do you do?
You do half and half. So you sort of like over a year, you have sort of so many placement weeks in placement. Mine, it differs to every university because some universities do theirs sort of like 2 days in university, 3 days on placement, that sort of thing. But my university was a block. So we do like a block of 10 weeks in one go. So you do sort of 20, 25 weeks in placement, roughly sort of 20 or 22 to 25 depending what was going on in the year, because some years you did do a bit more because you do alternate placements and work outside of midwifery. You work in nursing and things like that.
And were your placements split over like labor ward and birth center and community?
Yeah, you do all sorts. I mean, in your first year they try to sort of like keep you to normality. So you sort of do a community sort of placement, and then you do sort of like a birth centre experience, a midwifery-led experience. And then obviously sort of as the course continues, you sort of have to step into sort of labour ward care, high-risk care. And then you also get to sort of like look at sort of SCABU, neonatal care as well. So you've got sort of like a rounded experience of everything.
So you've got, yeah, real sort of breadth.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, but then of course, then that comes the thing with that comes that you have to keep switching your brain from sort of like a low risk setting to a high risk setting and vice versa. So that can be quite a challenging thing when you're in your training.
Sounds like good training.
Yes, it is. It is good training, and it's very, you know, and although I'd say it does depend on your mentors, and it does depend on, you know, your actual outlook on it as well. I think it depends what sort of, you know, the person that you are as well. How much you get out of it, if that makes sense.
As part of the community thing, are you doing both antenatal and postnatal?
Yes. Yeah, you are. Yeah. And at the end of my degree, I'm doing a caseloading experience. So I'm doing looking after women throughout. But obviously, because we're only doing it for the last 12 weeks, we've taken on women sort of like that are in, you know, established in their pregnancies and stuff. So we're sort of getting them at sort of 26, 28 weeks. And looking after them. So that's been really, really challenging and really good at the same time, because then it's seeing the whole picture and providing that sort of continuity, which is really good.
Is that a new initiative for your area?
No, they've done it in our at my university for quite a few years now, and they end the degree with it because they feel it's almost it's a very big challenge, because it's almost it's decision making, it's, you know, it's care planning, it's you know, making the appropriate referrals for women, and also sort of being your own midwife, being, you know, being out there and sort of not having the mentor on your shoulder. So it's been a really, really good few weeks that I've been doing that, so it's been good.
What have you liked best?
What have I liked best through the whole degree?
Yeah.
Ah, no, that's really hard. I'd say when I was working in the birth centre, I think my whole sort of roots come from being in a birth centre, sort of like seeing what I did when I was as an MSW, which is a maternity support worker. I think that's, you know, that's part of what I want to do. So being there was one, you know, was really a great, great experience working there with those midwives. So
that's where your heart is.
That's where my heart is. But actually, I've just, you know, recently we were going to interviews for jobs now. That's where I'm at. I'm trying to get a job. And I recently was asked, you know, what do you really want to do? Where do you want to go? And I said that I actually want to help sort of bring sort of more normality to people that are having high risk pregnancies, because I think that's, you know, a lot of women don't get that.
Yeah,
they don't get some of the normal stuff that they can have, you know, and they sort of think, oh, well, because I'm on a labour ward, they're treated very, very medically, and you can make a difference to people's experiences.
How can you? What? Tell me what you can do.
Well, in terms of the rooms, you can sort of move the furniture a bit, because it's, you know, it's that bed in the right in the centre of the room does everybody, doesn't it? You walk in and you sit on it or you lay on it. So when you're down in the birth centre, there's, you know, beds, but they're to the side, they're out of the way, they're in a cupboard, they're folded up, you know, they're not there prominent. So that's one of the first things. And bringing some sort of normal stuff up there, sort of like the balls and the mats and, you know, the birthing stools that they have down in the birth centre, you know, bringing them up to the labour ward, it can make a real difference to the atmosphere in there. And I think it's the whole sort of privacy and dignity up there is a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So making sure that people know not to just walk in the doors, and that thing that keeps things normal as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When people aren't coming in and out of your room. Treating you like a patient, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. It's just out of interest that I was asking. The only birth I ever doula'd at, when we got to our room, it was the woman's second birth, and her partner and I just walked straight into the room and dumped all the bags on the bed, and you're not having that.
Exactly, yeah. Just treating it as a piece of furniture, not a bed, you know, just somewhere to put things maybe, or lean against maybe, and use to sort of prop yourself up a bit, but not to lay out flat in your pyjamas, you know.
Waiting for your twilight medicine.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. So what's next? You're looking for a job now?
Yeah, I'm looking for a job. Yeah. Anybody want to give me a job? No.
Go for it.
It's a tricky one, because obviously different trusts look for different things. And it is, it's a difficult one. And the actual process of getting a job is, you know, testing, and, you know, I fully appreciate that they need to test things, but that can be a lot of pressure. And also sort of interviewing and sort of talking the talk. Knowing what you want to do and what you can actually bring to the job. So not any like any other job interview at the end of the day, but yeah, feeling quite a bit of pressure at the moment to get a job.
Well, I wish you the very best of luck with it. Thank you very much for telling us your story.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Natalie.
Okay, what do you think? You can get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter.
So we've got a few excerpts from comments on Facebook.
Emma Pickett, re the ABM conference, says, can I just shout out to the wonderful Association of Breastfeeding Mothers conference coordinator, Liz O'Donoghue. She sorts it all out for us as a volunteer with help from our admin, Carla, and the committee supporting her. But Liz is our star. Liz is already thinking about the conference for next year.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, it was really, really incredibly well organised. Best conference I've been to in a long time. And we also had a comment from Carmen Pagor. She said, wow, what an episode. Well done, Sprogcast. Maureen spoke in my borough to a variety of health professionals, and myself and Amy Brown created a questionnaire looking at the impact on professionals' knowledge and attitude after hearing Maureen's milk hypothesis. And the results were clear, massive improvements to knowledge and attitudinal changes. This information needs to get out there for societal change, and Sprogcast, you are part of that. We like being part of that, don't we?
Oh, we love it. That's our mission, really. And Heather Welford says, enjoyed this, covered the wide territory of cutting-edge science, public health, practical support for mothers in a rights-based context, and I felt optimistic that things can change.
That's nice. We've mentioned our lovely sponsor, Pinter & Martin, a few times, and one of the things I wanted to publicise for them is their Being the Change one-day gathering that they've got going on at EFRA Space in Brixton, Friday the 16th of September this year, and it's a one-day gathering organised by the Positive Birth Movement for midwives, doulas, birth workers, and anyone who wants to improve the birth experience, hosted by Millie Hill, founder of the Positive Birth Movement, with some really, really cool speakers. She's got Sheena Byram, Rebecca Schiller, this Mark Harris bloke turns up again.
Yeah.
Claire Goggin on Caesarean in Focus, which sounds really interesting. And, oh, Catherine Williams. She's a friend of mine.
Oh.
Didn't know she was on the bill. I hadn't read all the way to the bottom of the page. Sounds like a really good thing to get involved with. It's £40 for a ticket, £30 for students and low income. And just sounds really ace. So I thought I would mention that today.
Brilliant. Is that your endorsement?
It can be.
No, it doesn't have to be.
Do you have an endorsement today, Mark?
Well, did you mentioned the Sprogcast listening party that happens every month on the 25th in EFRA Space.
Mm-hmm.
And I've experienced their coffee. It was fantastic.
Yeah, good.
I was going to endorse that conference. So you've really done it for me.
The Positive Birth Movement?
Yeah, I'm speaking there on transforming birth cultures, the stories we live in.
Oh, that'll be really good.
What are you laughing at?
Just laughing. My endorsement is Sling Libraries.
Oh, brilliant.
There are little Sling Libraries set up all around the place. Often NCT groups run them and children's centres have them. And I just think I wish we'd had that 10 years ago. I was totally put off by the options and not being able to find out anything about it. And basically, all I could do was order one from a website and try it. Whereas now you can go and you can put them on and someone will show you how to use it. And you can hire it for a week and then try a different one. And that would have been brilliant. I'd have loved that. And also, I've just read Rosie Knowles' book, Why Baby Wearing Matters, which was a nice little book.
Brilliant.
Is that it? Are we done?
Yeah.
If you have any suggestions or comments, get in touch via Facebook or Twitter.
That's facebook.com/Sprogcast and at Sprogcast on Twitter. And if you're listening on iTunes, why not leave us a review? Thanks for listening. And it's goodbye from me.
And it's also goodbye from me.
You've been listening to Sprogcast with Mark Harris and Karen Hall. Sprogcast is supported by Pinter & Martin. For all your pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding and parenting reading, check out pinterandmartin.com and enter the code SPROGCAST for an additional 10% off. Sprogcast is produced by Karen Hall with technical assistance by Pete Hall, and our branding is provided by Nick Hilditch.